Blog Talk Radio.
Took 105 days, but normal service has been resumed in more ways than one. The Premier League is back. La Liga's been back. The Bundesliga's been back. Serie A's back. Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle is once again showing soccer. And after a brief hiatus, I have my partner in crime back. Stead, how goes it this evening?
It's going great. Going great. Happy to be back. I had to take a little personal day. Things are getting a little hectic. But yeah, can't complain, man. I mean, life overall is still pretty good.
So, that can only mean it is time once again for the Two Guys Soccer Show. And we are brought to you, as always, by the fine folks at Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland. Maryland's premier social distancing restaurant. And as of Friday at 3 p.m., once again, home Premier League football. It was nice to go down there and watch a game for the first time. British Will came down and joined me, and we had a good time watching Man United and Tottenham. I don't know how many games I'm going to be able to get out there to watch because they're not opening up until 3. But those ones that I can, I will certainly go down there and take care of them and watch down there. So maybe at some point in the future, Stead, you'll be able to make an appearance once again.
Yep, hopefully soon. Yeah, definitely.
And occasionally we talk about our adult beverage of choice, and I wanted to give a big shout-out to British Wills Brewing Company, who provided me with a lovely selection of his finest homebrews. I'm sipping on a nice Hefeweizen right now. That he made. It's actually quite good.
Didn't know British Lab was doing the homebrew. I'm a fan of the homebrew.
Not only is he doing the homebrew, before the classes ended at Maryland, he was actually teaching a course at University of Maryland on brewing.
Wow.
It was a chemistry elective.
Yeah. Yeah, you learn something new every day. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. So his stuff is actually pretty good. It's quite tasty. I'm liking this Hefeweizen. It's got a lot of good. It's very bold. It's got a lot of good flavors. It's as close as I've had to a good German Hefeweizen in a bottle here in the States. So
yeah.
I'm very proud of the man, and I'm interested to see what his other creations are. So we've got a busy show tonight. We'll be joined shortly by our good friend El Haji Fall. He's going to give us his perspective on how this restart, project restart, across the various divisions has, well, restarted. And a little bit later, Uncle Leo Haggerty is going to join us from our sister show, our Tuesday show. And he's going to talk a little bit about what professional sports in the United States might be able to learn from soccer. So, but before we get there, Stead, and I will give you a chance to vent a little bit later on in the show on Arsenal, who I knew were the big story.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure I specifically cleared out some time We may be joined by our friend from across the pond, who just popped in. Sean,
all right.
Here. Sean,
there he is.
How goes it?
I'm going very well indeed. How are you, Sue?
We are doing quite well. We were just ruminating on the fact that normal service was resumed, and I was going to ask Mr. Stead about his experience, and I said to him, I will give him the opportunity, and you, the opportunity to vent about Arsenal a little bit later on. I feel like that's going to – we've carved out a solid 20-minute segment of the show just for you guys to vent about Arsenal, which I feel like you may need. But
it's
I want to
get
your – yes. Yes, I could do a whole entire 90 minutes on them,
yep.
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
But I wanted to get your impressions, and I'll start with you, Stead, on how you thought the restart went, how you felt about the games, just how nice it was to be able to once again tune in and watch Premier League football on the weekend or on Wednesday for you as well.
Yeah, yeah. I tuned in right away on Wednesday. I really wanted to see the first game back. I think it was me to kind of stamp my loyalty to the Premier League card. But I was actually quite pleased with the Villa Sheffield game. It was relatively what I expected. I mean, yes, things weren't crisp. There was definitely evidence of lots of rust that had built up. But you saw the spirit was there, and the players seemed genuinely happy to be playing again. But I think also one thing I liked about watching these early games is I thought you could get a really good look. What are the areas that these teams truly are struggling? And where are they going to need to do some transfers over the summer or to develop some younger players? Or you could really see where those holes were a lot more pronounced with these games, at least from my perspective, than I think at normally when you get to this point in the season where the teams have kind of gelled a bit more. So it was kind of weird. You're seeing relative preseason-esque soccer or football when you consider that players don't get 100 days off normally. I mean, that just doesn't happen. So you saw kind of like an extra level of preseason play in a way. But with the games actually carrying a lot more weight and a lot more meaning. So there was that sense of urgency there, even though that sense of skill may not have been there. So you saw a lot of feeling out. I think Man City was really feeling out Arsenal at the beginning of that game on Wednesday. And I felt like you kind of got a lot of that. I think one of the most striking things was the teams that were lower in the table who you're kind of wondering, well, what is the real Achilles heel? And you're seeing, you know, certain teams just can't score goals. And you're seeing the lack of, like, the ability to finish and things like that. You saw a lot of that with Norwich. You saw a lot of that with West Ham, where they just couldn't get the ball in the net. And, you know, that's really what kind of separates the for a lot of these teams, because they're really, you can really have a lot, not too much separation with some defenses outside of Arsenal and some midfield play. But you're seeing that ability to put the ball in the goal, that final touch is really where you see teams struggle. But overall, happy to be back. And, you know, I went from being excited about the league returning to immediately starting to analyze games in about 15 minutes.
It didn't take long for me to slide into that either, and I was picking apart the Villa-Chelsea match with Leo over text message, and I was struck by how quickly and just how easily it was for me to slide back into looking at and ignoring everything else about the game and just kind of looking at it from the analyst perspective of what is Villa trying to do here.
Mm-hmm.
And where would they be successful? Ultimately, they weren't. But looking at Chelsea and saying, like, look, why aren't they doing more movement off the ball? Why are they being so static? Why are they letting Villa and then, you know, his the substitutions of Barkley and Pulisic, is that going to pay off? He's sacrificing offense for defense. He may get something going forward, and they've had 80% of possession, but they're really going to leave themselves open at the back. It didn't come to pass. Sean, I know you had a bit of a get-together on Wednesday.
I did.
Don't feel like that. I'm sure the get-together was nice, even if the game didn't go according to plan.
Living dangerously.
I was probably as excited as a 9-year-old waiting for Santa to come down the chimney, to be honest. So I was delighted on several fronts. Firstly, we thought it was going to rain in England on Wednesday, and it didn't. The sun came out, and the sun shone very brightly for the start of our Premier League. So I managed plan A went to pot. I couldn't get the projector to project onto the screen in daylight. So plan B came into play, which was basically taking my 55-inch television into the garden. in the garden, and my Manchester City friend came across, and my Arsenal friend came across. And yeah, I, like the two of you, hugely excited to see Premier football back on television again. And within an hour, hugely embarrassed that here we are with the most expensive league on the planet. And even me, with my dodgy eyesight, see the ball cross the line in the game between Aston Villa and Sheffield United, with the referee desperately looking at his watch and pointing at his watch and God knows what else. So that was a bit of a a bit of a shocker, I thought, for the first game back with billions across the world watching that we couldn't even get a ball across the line decision correct. But yeah, no, very excited, and like the two of you, fascinating. I think with so many games on, I've watched most of the games, not all of them. Very interesting to see what teams are trying to do and what they're trying to achieve. I'm very grateful for you guys for having put me on the show a few weeks back, because I felt that the first week of the Premier League was pretty similar to the first week that the Bundesliga came back. I think teams haven't quite yet got in their stride. And then, of course, there's Arsenal, but we'll come on to that a bit later on.
Yeah, if there was anything that could be more English than in the very first game, in the first half of the first game,
correct,
we get a VAR officiating just kerfuffle, to say the least.
Absolutely.
I want to bring in another voice to the conversation, a good friend of ours. Mr. El Hadji Fall. El Hadji, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, guys. How's everybody's doing? So, been listening to you guys since the beginning. happy to join. Thank you for having me again.
So, we have all been talking briefly about our excitement that the Premier League is back. I know that the Premier League is one of your favorite leagues, but you are a general soccer connoisseur, probably more so than all of us, given your desire, your inclinations to watch matches from all over the world. How did you feel the Premier League restart went when compared to the Bundesliga or La Liga or any of the other leagues?
Well, I was very happy to see them come back. You know, I'm a big, you know, this is one of the best league in the world, and I, you know, watch it with excitement. One thing that I was really happy to see, you know, I don't want to go in the, you know, on the tangents here, you know, I was very happy to see all the player making statement, you know, with the Black Lives Matter, supporting the movement here in the States. So I was moved by it. I was very happy to see them all in Black Lives Matter jersey and kneeling at the beginning, and just kind of really making a statement with their jerseys and kneeling. So I was very happy to see that. Even though, you know, Sadio Mane forgot, you know, at the beginning of the Liverpool game to kneel. So, you know, it shows that he want to go out there and start scoring goals. So I'm not holding that against him right now. So I was very happy to see that, basically. So I don't know how you guys feel about that, but it was a good, you know, feeling for me to see them, you know, support this movement, you know, that makes big noise here in the U.S.
I was very struck by that. I'm sure you were, Stead. Sean, probably as well. I thought it was a really great and very powerful statement for a sport that has had its run-ins, both soccer in general and the EPL. Stead, you and I talked about some of the racism racial issues that were coming up earlier in the season. I thought it was a very, very powerful message that all the players banded together. And I was really, 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 really especially struck by Pep Guardiola's comments after the Manchester City Arsenal game, when he said that white people need to apologize. And Spain has been one that has a country that has certainly had issues with racism in soccer in the past, and for to have somebody of his stature both in Spain and internationally come out and so bluntly say what he said, I felt was very, very, very telling. He did not couch that comment in any way, shape, or form. It was just about as blunt as it could be. And I really thought that was an important message, and I commend him on his willingness to stand up and say that. And let's make no bones about it, Pep may not be an native English speaker, but his English is quite good, and he can communicate what he wants to say.
Yeah, he's been speaking English long enough to know what he was trying to say. And to piggyback on what you're saying, Mike, I, and as well as Elhaj, I think it's important too that the fact that not only are you seeing this in England, but you're seeing this in Germany as well, where Germany had been also having the players were having demonstrations. But to see that league in England in particular doing this sends a strong message to the other leagues in UEFA that says, hey, look, we are the number one league. We know we're the number one league. And this is the stance that the players are taking. You would hope that that would in some way influence the leagues of the other big five. And then on top of that, some of the other leagues that may not be big five leagues, but still have, you know, strong talent in those. I'm speaking of like Portugal or in the Netherlands and maybe some Scandinavian countries where you're hoping that they'll see that gesture and say, okay, we're done. We have to instruct our fans and really put a strong statement that says this is now unacceptable, and not to the point where you're simply looking for the one fan and you hopefully ban the fan, but for really to have actual consequences, because it truly is the fans that are the ones that are perpetuating this. So unless they can put down some real consequences, but you're hoping that this movement, that this gesture by the Premier League, because the reason why it's called the Premier League and it was called the Premier League first, is that that will influence the other leagues to to stop behaving the way they're behaving and wake up and catch up with the times.
Yeah, and I just wish that the fan was there to witness that, you know, live, you know. That would be, I think, you know, would be more powerful, you know, to teach those fans, you know, the bad, you know, apples there that, hey, you know what, from now on, we can't do that, you know. And I wish that there was, like, you know, fans there live witnessing that, that gesture. You know, I was very moved by it, and they made a powerful statement, like you said, and they will set an example, and people will follow, I think. Yes, that was the biggest impression that I had. You know, I was happy to see that, and I was happy to see, you know, Liverpool. You know, that was.
Well, what did you make of the Liverpool draw? You and I talked about this briefly yesterday, so you know where I'm going to go with this, but I'll let you talk first.
The level of play wasn't what I was, you know, used to looking at Liverpool. I mean, you know, Grant, it's like 100-something days without, you know, playing a high-level soccer, basically. So they're easing into it. You know, I think this, the match could go either way, really, because both teams have, like, good chances to convert, you know, those action into goals. But I think the lack of the atmosphere, like, you know, just, like, there's a lot of aspect to it, you know. The lack of the atmosphere, you know, it's really weighing on these guys. Being laid off for 100-plus days, the lack of atmosphere without fans, And also, we didn't have Mo Salah. So I can forgive these guys for an average game, basically. It wasn't the greatest game of all, basically. And I think with Mo Salah there, I don't know about this guy, Minamino or whatever, this little kid. I don't know about him. So.
Well, it's funny that you bring that up. British Will, who also does Liverpool for us, was one of the ones who said he's already unfairly being branded as one of the biggest busts. And he hasn't really gotten a lot of game time, so it's hard to really make a judgment on him as of yet what he's going to
make. Yeah.
I feel as though this confirmed, and yes, it's a one-game sample size, but there have been other games that feed into this, that it confirms what I thought about Jurgen Klopp and how he is going to prepare this team. Yes, I think they want to win. Yes, I think they are trying to win. But what I saw in this game was a decrease in the sense of urgency. They knew they didn't have to. And they didn't play as a team that was going out to knowing that they had to, that they should, that there was this sense of urgency. There wasn't that additional pressure that they felt that they needed, because the Premier League is pretty much wrapped up for them. They are no longer in Europe. They're no longer in the FA Cup. And the records don't mean anything to Klopp. I think he's going to win the games that he can. And I think the only game left on the schedule that he really, really, really cares about winning is the Man City game. And
well,
should that be
the title decider?
Then,
maybe,
yes.
You know, we wanna win this, you know, at City. You know, it would be nice, you know, if we wouldn't, you know, against Crystal Palace, and then we'll win it at City too. So it's a thing on the cake, basically.
But that was 3 points. But I do think the lack of atmosphere, that was one thing that I definitely noticed in that particular game, because that was the first real derby that we've seen. The Merseyside derby played without fans was lacking something. It just wasn't the same without the fans in the stadium. And you notice a true lack of atmosphere, the piped in crowd noise that was evident on the didn't suffice to recreate what the atmosphere at Goodison Park would have been had there actually been fans in the stadium.
Yeah. And you can also point out, too, that NBC's, at least over here in the States, the teams, the networks that are handling the crowd noise, the network that's handling the Bundesliga is a lot better at it than the network that's handling the Premier League.
I will say that I saw them get a little bit better with it as the weekend wore on. Like, they were actually able to talk to, like, crowd noise, cheering at appropriate times, booing at appropriate times as the weekend went on. And that was going to be my next statement for all three of you. Haji said, you guys watch the same game, the same feed, pretty much, that I do. I'll start on the far eastern side of this round table with London. Sean, how was the production for the games over in the UK, Sean?
The production was interesting. A lot of the games are being televised on Sky, which has the lion's share of the Premier League matches. So what Sky have very cleverly done is they've actually put on two channels, one where you can hear crowd noise and the other where you don't hear crowd noise, and basically they've left it down to the viewer. I haven't yet seen any feedback to tell us whether fans on the whole prefer the noise or not. From a personal perspective, I was interested to listen to the games without the crowd noise, really, just to see if I could hear any swearing.
So the regular feed on the U.S. channels on NBC Sports and NBC had it with the crowd noise, and if you wanted it without the crowd noise, you had to stream it. But the native stream, the first one that you hit when you went to the app to stream it, was the one without crowd noise. So
right.
I initially thought that they were only doing it on TV. I didn't realize that they were doing it streaming similar where you could get it with either one. El-Haji, what did you think of the overall production of the Premier League, the viewing experience, sitting at home watching it? I trust with your two sons. Maybe your daughter and the babies as well. I don't know, but I have a feeling that boys were there.
Yeah, yeah, the two boys, you know, definitely, you know, we're watching it. Again, it's just like, you know, the stadium without fans seems weird. And the crowd noise, like, you know, somebody alluded earlier, wasn't that great either. I hope, you know, the fans will come sooner than later. For the game, all that we watch, you know, that, you know, like my thing, you know, really struck. And right now I'm wondering where to get those jersey, you know, especially, you know, any jersey would do. I miss the fans, basically.
I do as well. Well, we want to thank you for joining us, El-Haji, and giving us a little bit of your time. We'll have you back in a couple of weeks to get your impressions. All right, so thanks you very much, and you have a good week, and I'll look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks, and maybe we can get together and watch the game live.
And the boys are very excited about, like, going watching the my new game. So some Man U fans, you know, in our house. You know, I don't know, you know, you're doing some voodoo or so, but one of my boys is, like, starting, like, getting interested in Man U for some reason, so I don't know what's going on.
You can't go wrong with that. So thank you very much, my friend, and happy Father's Day to you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, guys. Happy Father's Day to everybody.
Thank you. Happy Father's Day.
Instead, what was your impression of the production of the games?
Well, I mean, when it comes to the pre-shows and the halftime shows, I mean, NBC just does a considerably better job of just providing analysis and commentary and prepping you and everything like that. And I think the commentating for NBC is it's a step up. I mean, I'm not the biggest Efe Nwokolo fan, but, you know, he's doing okay. He's getting better. Overall, I thought the production was fine. I really thought that I would have more of an issue without the fans there, but for some reason, I'm okay with it. I think at first it seemed like, you know, I know watching the La Liga, especially because the games come on pretty late over there in Spain, and it looked like a bunch of guys broke into the stadium after dark and tried to have a kickabout before they got in trouble from the police. So at least I was like, it looks kind of weird because all the lights are on and everything. But, you know, I'm enjoying it, and I think the fact that that element is taken out of the game, I'm able to focus more on the play, and I'm just not hearing it. And so, I think though, what's made it easier for me to do that is the fact that the crowd noise is being pumped in, and I kind of like the crowd noise. At first, I didn't like it, but now that I've gotten used to it from the Bundesliga and seeing how, and you are right. I mean, NBC did get better at that as I progressed, because initially it was pretty bad. It's not as much of a deal breaker as I thought it would be. And I know a couple of the guys in our text group have commented that it's really hard to watch the games. And I don't know. I, for some reason, I can't pinpoint it, but I'm really enjoying that just watching the game on the field. And I feel like a lot of the glitz and glamour have been removed by not having fans there. So I don't know. I think that I'm gonna. This is a probably a one-time thing. You know, I might not see this again. So I'm trying to kind of look at it that way too. Is this is something that we can talk about in 20 or 30 years. Like, remember when we watched Half the Premier League and there were no fans in the stadium, they had pictures up, and then we can talk about what's going on in Korea and everything like that. So I kind of want to just kind of soak it in while we can.
The production of these games has always been something that intrigued me about how was the viewing experience going to be. And I have talked at length, sometimes to you. I don't know whether I've had this conversation with Sean about different sports and different viewing experiences and how different sports translate live versus live in person versus on television. Soccer is one of the ones. Soccer football is one of the ones that actually translates pretty well, both live and watching on TV. I feel like either way you watch it, it's still a pretty good experience. I don't feel like you lose too much not being in media. Whereas, for instance, baseball is a sport that you almost have to watch live. Football is way better on TV. American football is way better on TV than it is in person. Hockey, kind of, you gain something but you lose something when you're not in the stands. Basketball is another one. So I've been very interested in seeing how these games are produced. I think NBC has done a great job. I love the fact that they put in a pre and a post game show, which is something that we hadn't had here in the States when it came to the Bundesliga. And I like that analysis. I like that. And you get a lot. I will transition into the goal that wasn't, because we knew something was up when we did not get a graphic at halftime that showed the Hawkeye and whether or not the goal had crossed the line.
Right.
I mean, the fact that there wasn't a graphic within, I would say, about 2 or 3 minutes told me something was wrong. And I consider this to be an abject failure all the way around of over-reliance on technology. The fact that everybody was willing to disregard what they saw with their eyes because the technology didn't work. So all I can say is that the referee said, oh, it didn't go over my watch, so it can't be a goal because it would have gone off. And so there must have been something. And the VAR officials who had, and NBC told us, 67 seconds to radio down to the ref and say, we want to have a look. Said, well, we looked at him and saw that he didn't indicate on his watch that, or was indicating that the watch had not gone off. This over-reliance on technology. And it was just, it was a really bad advert for VAR. I think there were things that VAR has done right. I think there's been things that they have done wrong. I think the biggest beef that I have settled on with VAR has been, and Sean, this is one where you're uniquely qualified to talk on it, the lack of transparency. Because you and I both have watched cricket. And I love the cricket refs. When they go to a replay in cricket for an LBW, you can hear everything that they're thinking. In rugby, the refs are mic'd up. You can hear everything the replay thinks. And I think when you are at a point where you have fans developing algorithms to tell us what players are good versus what players we shouldn't invest in, what we want is information. We don't care that you don't make the same call that we did. We want to make sure you know why. And would that alleviate, Sean, some of the problems with VAR if they mic'd up the referee and let us hear what they were saying to each other?
Would it alleviate? I'm not sure it would, Mike. I mean, this is the one aspect of the Premier League which, on the whole, is highly professional. When it comes to the refereeing, it's an absolute joke in my view. We can go back to really the start of this season. Is this our second season with VAR, I think? But they've obviously
it's the first,
isn't it? Yeah. So, yes, that's right. Sorry, it's the first in the Premier League, wasn't it? There was VAR, but in other competitions last year. I think what's happened in the Premier League is the referees have abdicated their responsibility and are waiting for VAR to make the decisions. So in my view, it's been a complete step backwards. What happened on Wednesday in that first game was just scandalous. I was watching the game without my glasses, and even I could see that the ball was bloody over the line, and you know I was hundreds of miles away from where it was happening. So I do think that's poor. We are absolutely, totally over-reliant on technology. But the interesting thing with the goal on Wednesday during the Villa-Sheffield United game is that that isn't even attached to VAR. There's a separate system that supposedly is doing the calculations as to whether it's Hawkeye, isn't it? Whether the ball crosses the line or not. So the two things
and
are
they
actually...
said it was a once in 9,000 occurrence. 9,000 games is the first time that that has happened to them. And I can buy that if you're saying it's a once in, you figure, what, 3 goals per game, 27,000, 1 in 27,000. No. But I don't think that excuses the abdication of VAR from saying, like, we are going to take a look at this. The ball went into the net. We should have
Correct.
A look to see what
Correct.
Actually happened.
Yeah, and you only had to look at the reaction of the players. It was pretty obvious to me, not only did I see the ball potentially cross the line, but about 5 Sheffield United players reacted there and then. And that doesn't happen unless the players have seen some sort of injustice. I think the only good thing that happened was that Sheffield United got absolutely drubbed in the next game, didn't they, against Newcastle? Because if Sheffield United missed out on Europe by a point, you could see some lawsuits flying around, really, couldn't you? But
I never thought that I would hear somebody say that justice was served by Sheffield United actually losing.
Yeah.
That, how much of a hash has the English Premier League made out of technology?
Yeah, I mean, Sean basically said everything word for word. I mean, it's actually appalling to see that the ref is pointing to the watch as the reason why he is unable to make a call in front of the players. He's basically looking at the players going, so with his hands up in the air, pointing down, going, I didn't hear anything. And you know, to see a goalkeeper with his entire body in the webbing of the net and to not think that I should take a look at this is that was the most shocking piece. And you saw the Villa players were not reacting. They just stood there. They're like, okay, I guess we got away with one. But if they had been out by a point, I mean, Sheffield looked so bad against Newcastle that at least you're going, okay, phew. And you know, the Premier League is also, you know, wiping the sweat from the brow, going, okay, well, I'm glad we can hopefully put that one behind us. But that is going to be a huge black eye on this moving forward, because that, when you, especially for a team like Sheffield that has gotten to where they've gotten to this season on possession, defense, and scoring like every now and then when you get a really good opportunity, they're not putting the ball in the net that much. So when they do get goals, to take that one away like that is really, really going to sting. And I think though, you know, they're going to stay up, and I know that's primarily the goal. I'm sure if you told Sheffield fans that, you know, no matter what happens, you were going to be in this situation where you're sitting in eighth place with, you know, 10 with 8 games to go, they'd be pretty happy about that. So at least that could be something to kind of alleviate some of the pressure they may feel going forward.
I want to bring in another voice to the conversation and shift a little bit. Hey, Uncle Leo, how's it going this evening?
It's going fine, Mike. How about with you?
I can't complain too much. You're on with my faithful co-host, Stead, and London Sean. Leo co-hosts the host our sister show on Tuesday nights, where you talk NFL football. And so we're doing a bit of a crossover thing. I did your show last week, and you're doing mine this week. So tell everybody, tell both of our listeners where they can hear you and what you're doing on Tuesdays.
Oh, you mean we got two of them tonight? I'm impressed.
Yeah, paid both of them.
Yeah, I can tell. Yeah, the Sherpa and I, a.k.a. Paul Perrone, the producer of the both shows, we host Night Sports Radio, and we go from 8 to 10 at night and have some interesting guests on. Tomorrow we're going to talk to Don Harnum, the writer AD, as to what it's like with coronavirus and no football program to worry about. So that'll be interesting. And then at the end of the show, we'll have Scott Westering, our NCAA analyst, talking about what this would be like trying to coach during a pandemic. And that'd be crazy. And next week, Mikey, I know you'll like this. The lovely Roxanne Wilder is going to join us, and also Greg Cosell from NFL Films.
Well, say hi to both of them. I miss them very much. It's been a while since I've talked to either one of them. I may just pop on through for a listen for that. But, Leo, you cover all things American sports. And the big question I have for you, what do you think that American sports can learn from how soccer has restarted?
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, because there's not a whole lot of comparisons to the four major American sports, basically because of size and location. The two sports that where you have similar size teams, hockey and basketball, are indoors. So there's your big problem right there. Football and baseball, you got rosters in the 30s and with football in the 50s. And it's going to be – I really like the way that the European Soccer League has decided on how they're going to deal with the bench. And, again, I watched it with the Premier League. You have actually specific spots you can sit in, and if somebody's there already, you got to go up in the stands. They are taking extreme precautions to make sure that when they are not on the pitch. You like that, Mike? I remembered that.
Yes. You're learning.
Yeah, I'm learning. When they're not on the pitch, they need to have social distancing, because there's no telling what's going on. And we are starting to see a reoccurrence of it over here in all four major sports, football, basketball, baseball, and hockey. Because I think we got back at it too soon.
So as far, Leo, as the games are produced, as far as what they're doing with the production, the piping in crowd noise, do you think that is something that would be viable for the four major professional sports here in the U.S.?
Oh, I think you have to. If you don't, it's a glorified scrimmage. You're looking at, and the closest thing we have over here is the WWE. And, you know, they were putting on events with nothing other than the referee and the two combatants, or the four combatants. It was a tag team. And there was no buzz. There was no pizzazz. I looked at the Bundesliga when it first came back. Same thing. There wasn't anything there. You've got to pipe in crowd noise, and the Atlanta Falcons know how to do that. They've been accused of it for years, piping in crowd noise. But you've got to have it, because if not, it's a glorified scrimmage. And I think the Premier League, the Bundesliga, they sat down and said, look, how can we make this as close to being normal as we can? Okay, they put up fake fans behind the goals. They started to pipe in crowd noise, and they're starting to get an idea of what it's like. Now, I'll tell you what, I don't think any of them want to go for an extended period of time without fans. That's just, could you imagine having the Champions League And the finals, nobody there. I mean...
Well, we don't need to imagine it, Leo, because we're going to have it. It's a reality.
Yeah.
It's going to happen in August. We're going to get it, and we're going to like it, and we're going to watch it. And it's not
mm-hmm.
going to be the same. So,
no.
To say, can I imagine it? I don't need to, because I know it's going to happen come August.
Yeah, and you know what, Mike? I want to, your two listeners, or their friends, whatever, to go to itsportsmag.com and check out my Saturday posting, because I finally had enough, and I said, what if this goes to September of 2021? What if we have no sports in the United States for another year? And I think college athletic programs will collapse, and the big problem will be soccer, because they will be eliminated. All the non-revenue sports, soccer, baseball, gymnastics, you name it. I'll tell you what, the major football programs, that's the engine that drives the athletic bus. And if that engine's out of there, there's going to be schools that are either going to have to drop specific sports or maybe drop their entire athletic program. And that's a tough thing, because you're going to see sports like soccer. You're going to see sports like baseball, softball. They're going to fall by the wayside because colleges won't be able to afford them. And
yeah, well, you've
Mike,
been seeing soccer programs fall in the United States for the past 20 years. They've been falling left and right. And without much fanfare, too, they don't really say it. But, you know, my alma mater had a good soccer program, and 5 years after I left, it was gone.
Well, I think a lot of that had to do with Title IX as well. Because, and again, the biggest problem with Title IX is you've got to take football out of the equation, because there's no 90-plus scholarship sports for women. If you keep football out, made that separate, you can keep your soccer programs. You can keep everything, because everything is balanced from there. You know what schools are using as a woman's program to try to balance out the football? Crew. It's amazing. They'll have 30 or 40 girls on crew rowing scholarships just to try to balance out football, and that's a mistake.
What type of revenue are we looking at being lost?
Oh, wow.
If we can't have college football. Like, give us a perspective on the amount of money that a Division I FBS program could lose by not being able to have a football
team.
Either
okay,
with
this is, again,
no fans
Mike,
in the stands.
We got lucky, and Paul and I were at the Outback Bowl, and Wisconsin was playing Tennessee. And Barry Alvarez was the athletic director, and Jim Thompson was the athletic director of Tennessee. And I asked Barry Alvarez point blank, I said, how many home games do you need to cover your athletic budget? He said, I need 7, and every fourth year I need an 8th, whether it's a neutral site game or something that provides revenue. I asked Tennessee the same thing. He said, we need 7. I said, okay. Now I asked him a question. I said, how much money do you make off of a home football game? Never expecting an answer. Now, this is 12 years ago. $4 million in ticket revenue at Neyland Stadium in Tennessee. That was, now you could probably double that. They are probably making with concessions and parking and tickets and memorabilia, they're making in excess probably of $10 million a game. So, yeah, you're losing all sorts of the ability to get your brand out there to people. And that's another thing that really has no price tag. But Mike, instead, and London John, I'm assuming
Sean,
you're over there.
London Sean.
Well, I was talking to London John. I think he's the other listener.
Oh, London John is the other listener. London Sean is the other co-host.
He's
yes.
my cousin.
Yeah, well.
Oh, that's his cousin.
Yeah, good on you. Good on you, mate. That's good. So it can't happen. You've got to have people. And guys, I'm going to throw this out to you. And this is what I think is going to happen with football. I think the NCAA and the NFL are going to play, and they're going to tell fans, come at your own risk. And that's going to be a free-for-all.
Well, that would be an interesting development. My last question to you, Leo, is this, and I'll turn it over and see if the guys have anything before I let you go. How much do you think college football and college sports and the NBA, NFL, NHL have looked at soccer and the fact that they've been able to restart the way that they had and said, thanks for the roadmap?
Oh, absolutely. They've taken a look. All the American sports are so happy that European soccer has stepped forward and made an attempt, because it's basically trial and error. Again, when this hit, the ADs and the coaches and the commissioners and the league officials, they didn't open to their section of their league handbook under pandemics and see how to deal with this. This is flying by the seat of your pants, literally and figuratively. There is no playbook on how to deal with this. The smartest thing that the Americans have learned from soccer is don't rush it. I think they're pumping the brakes over here just to see that, okay, they got the right idea over there. We've got to put this thing in a bubble and make sure.
All right. Thanks a lot, Leo, for joining us. Once again, give a shout-out to the show tomorrow night, and hopefully both of our listeners will tune in and get a little bit of education on the NFL.
Oh, yeah. We'll work on it. Hey, guys, thanks for having the rookie on, and anytime you need me, just give me a call.
Will do.
Leo
Haverty, host of Night Sports Radio, which he does with producer Paul on Tuesday nights from 8 to 10. All right, gentlemen, it is that time. Arsenal Vent Radio. Arsenal dropped their opening game to City 3-0, and then a pretty awful loss at Brighton 2-1, which featured a really horrific injury to Berglano. I'm going to give you the next however long either I deem necessary or you guys go to just vent about Arsenal. So I'll start with you, London Sean, since you are the longer suffering Arsenal fan.
I am the longer suffering Arsenal fan. 49 years of it, unfortunately. Well, there was lots of anticipation before the start of the restart of the Premier League on Wednesday. I think most Arsenal fans were thoroughly looking forward to continuing with the mini momentum that we had gained as far back as March 2020. My God, over 100 days ago. And as the teams came out on the pitch, I'd be interested to hear your views, Sted, on the team formation. But I think that team formation now can be explained a little bit more after some news that came out in the UK today. But I was not unhappy with the formation, but I couldn't believe my eyes that within 4 minutes we lose pretty much our only defensive midfielder in the Arsenal squad nowadays. Xhaka went down with what looked like a pretty season-ending injury to his ankle. And then that was followed by losing one of our three fit central defenders about 16 minutes later. So 20 minutes into our restart, we were pretty severely disadvantaged with the loss of both of those players. And obviously that also meant that we lost two substitutions. I can't say for a second that Arsenal deserved anything at all from that game, but I had unfortunately somewhat forgotten or put in the annals of my memory the disasters that Mr. Luiz could occasionally bring to a football match. And my God, did he do it in spades on Wednesday. So what was announced today over here in the UK is that we actually had a player tested positive for COVID-19 last week. And they're not saying which player, but player has COVID-19. Well, I think that the clever money is that it could be Torreira, because Torreira looked super fit when he was putting pictures up on Instagram throughout those 100 days off, showing off his new six-pack. So I was a little bit surprised to not see him play or start the game against Man City. So not only now have we lost four first-team players, and when I say first-team players, players that would, I think, automatically get into our first team. There's obviously mystery surrounding Mesut Ozil again. No one's too sure what the hell has happened with him in the background. But I have to say that I really do feel for Mikel Arteta. I think, Stead, you did join me in saying that a lot of Arsenal fans do feel that he is the man to sort of lead us forward, but you know, I'm not sure how much bad luck the poor bugger can get, really, considering that we've lost all those players in those first two games. Going back to watching games with and without crowd sound in the background, I happened to watch the Brighton game without the crowd sound, and you could hear Leno scream probably in my back garden, even though I was watching it inside the house. It was a very, very bad injury. Pretty obvious straight away that something terrible had occurred and happened. And I think really the disappointment, and I'll echo what Arteta said after the City game, you know, not many teams are going to go to Man City and get a result, as Burnley found out tonight as well. So you can't be too harsh on the team. But I think I said on the pod a couple of weeks ago that if we had any aspirations of getting into Europe, which has got to be what the objectives of the club are this season, we had to start off with at least a point at City. So I'd already resigned myself to the fact that probably Europe was slightly out of reach after the City result. What was really disappointing about the Brighton result was the lack of competitive edge in the team. I really thought when we went 1-0 up, I thought, okay, come on, let's shut up shop. And it was just an unravelling of the last 13 minutes. We were awful. We were second to the ball and everything. The team was losing its discipline, its mental focus. And how we ended up losing, I'm still not too sure. Have I got over it? Probably not. But I don't like the look of going away to Southampton on Thursday this week. And I think we could unfortunately be staring at a third successive defeat. I hope not, but if we do look at a third successive defeat, then I think the natives will start getting restless, which is a huge shame. How about you, Stead? How did you feel? Were you as disappointed as myself?
Yeah, I was. I can't... it was hard to articulate. I was trying to send texts to some people, and my thumbs were shaking during the Man City game. And because what was really striking about it was I had no belief that we would even get a point at Man City, and that wasn't really the thought process. It was, yes, you were the last team to have not lost a game yet in 2020 in Europe. Blah blah blah. That was a funny little statistic that occurred. Issue I had though is something that's been plaguing Arsenal for 10, 20, probably 10 years, maybe 15 years now, is that this team folds when things get difficult. They just die. And I don't know where this comes from. It is the most extraordinarily frustrating thing. But you look at the Man City game, Arsenal had 3 shots and 0 shots on target. And this is a team that, if nothing else, has been able to mount some level of offense. They've scored 41 goals this year. And they have 13 draws thanks to the goalkeeper. So you're looking at it going, the only statistic, and also you had less fouls, which means you weren't going for the 50-50 balls with the same level of heart. So you had given up completely. You haven't seen a Luis, you haven't seen that type of a collapse from a substitute for Arsenal since Emmanuel Eboué did that, what was that, 8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago?
Yeah.
I mean, and David Luiz was just starting to get to that point where Arsenal fans were going, you know what, maybe we should keep him around for one more year. And now we're sitting here going, look, like, this is how bad it's gotten, where the player that we were all begging for Arsenal to sell is one that we're now begging for him to start, and that is Nkodjo Mustafi. He seems to be the best middle central defender that we have right now. And now I'm going, whatever you do, don't sell him. You have to keep him. And so on top of that game, you get away from the City game, and if any team should have just rubbed some, you know, just go home, take, get a good night's sleep, you know what? At least your rust game was a game you weren't supposed to win anyway. That was your game to just lay an egg, and you did. You laid a huge egg. You only had 33% of the possession. You laid a huge egg. That was the game for that. The Brighton game is absolutely appalling because now Brighton completed the sweep against you. You've lost twice to a team that's battling relegation. And also, the guy who comes out and does a boneheaded play that injures your goalkeeper, you see Arsenal players kind of like rubbing him on the back, oh, you know, slapping five. And the only person who did anything to show that he was upset during the game was the person that was injured.
Yeah.
Where's your teammates?
Yeah.
Who's put the body on this guy? And then the rough salt in the wound, he scores the winning goal. Mm-hmm. He scores the winning goal. And then at the conclusion of the game, Matteo Guendouzi, you know, gives him a little nudge, gives him a bump and everything like that. And he was the only one who did anything. Now, we're also can easily fall in love with Guendouzi because he seems to be the only guy out there who plays with a sense of pride for his team. Even though he's often out of position and seems to be not really sure what he's supposed to be doing a lot of times, that he's only 21. But you can't fix lack of heart. You can't fix that. Players that fall into that realm and who want the game to come to them in the way they want it to, when it's not like that, they just don't know what to do with themselves. And then you have a team that gets bullied and pushed around and not respected time and time and time and time again. You're looking at – I don't think even the after the Southampton game, where Southampton looked pretty good, now you then you got to go to Sheffield. That's not going to be easy. Sheffield's ahead of you on the table, and they're probably pretty upset right now because they probably feel like they should have gotten at least 3 points out of these last two games. And, yeah, they had a rough outing against Newcastle. Bad plays by the central defender. You know, ball going through his legs to set up that first goal. You know, they got some bad luck. This is nothing new for Arsenal. They do this crap all the time. And it's every single time they're presented with an opportunity to truly change the fate of their season, they blow it. And that is the problem with this squad. That's what Arteta has to fix. You look at the young players on this squad, this is a talented, talented, talented group. There are some young players that can really make this team be very, very competitive moving forward, unless they fall into the same kind of like post-Patrick Vieira loop, where there's nobody out there that's going to put a body on somebody. There's nobody out there that's going to fire up the team and say, look what just happened to our goalkeeper, the guy who has basically been our best player all year long. Look what you're doing. And you know what? Aubameyang, get your head out of your butt. Stop thinking about your next contract because you have not been there these last two games. You haven't been there. He is not. So, you know, that's been my biggest disappointment is there's no heart in the team. The leadership is not there. I mean, the leadership is not there. And you have a coach, Arteta, who knows that this is a problem for Arsenal. He knows. He was a vocal leader on the team when he played for Arsenal and became captain of the team when really he's still an Everton guy. He's an Everton guy. He's not an Arsenal guy. And that image of Arteta as a player is the image you have of somebody who played with a lot of heart when he's not even an Arsenal guy, he's an Everton guy, it's beyond disappointing. It's beyond disappointing. And if they don't figure this out, they're looking at potentially being a mid-table. They could be the new Everton, the team that's never really going to compete for Champions League anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what scares me.
How depressing. But you're absolutely right.
I'm done.
I'm going to let you guys keep – I was going to say I was going to let you guys keep going because
I have said to both of you, I think that there is a lack of steel in the Arsenal lineup. There is nobody left to come who's going to say, I'm going to put my foot on the ball. Guendouzi came closest to doing it. I think he was immature in how he did it.
I agree.
He could potentially develop into that. But you brought up instead Patrick Vieira, who was the last player that I can remember at Arsenal who was a guy that could put their foot on the ball and say, you mess with him, you mess with me.
Right.
You know,
I mean, Per Mertesacker didn't do it. The guy's 6'6", central defender, and he was doing it as a tactical player. And I'm like, dude, you would get in your own
never
player,
his game.
But that you
that
know
was
what
never
though?
His game.
That is what I'm saying though. That is the you repeatedly bring in those players.
I mean, I think the last one we had, said to be fair, was Robert Sanchez, who, although was playing for himself, was also not afraid to get stuck in and stick up teammates and let people know he was around. But we have a distinct lack of leadership. And as much as I've not been a great Xhaka fan, really, since he signed, here's a really interesting fact. Since Arteta took over, Arsenal's Premier League record when Xhaka has completed 90 minutes is 9 games, no defeats, 4 clean sheets, 90 minutes for goals conceded. And Arteta's Premiership record when Xhaka fails to complete the 90 minutes is 3 games, 3 defeats, no clean sheets, 34 minutes for goals conceded. So you can just see there how important he is to Arteta's cause. And obviously, I think he's out now for the rest of the season. So I do fear for – I mean, luckily, we've got 40 points, which is generally enough to stay in the Premier League.
True.
So we won't have to be fighting relegation. But, I think we're going to be struggling to see where the next points are coming from, because looking at what we've got left, I mean, we might even have to call back Elneny from his loan spell.
Right. But Arsenal still has to play at Wolves. They have to play Leicester.
Yep.
They have to play at Spurs. They have to play Liverpool. So, I mean, look at the remaining fixtures that they have. And look, Adama Traore is a problem. That guy is a problem. He's a bowling ball who knows how to dribble. So, good luck stopping him. So now you're just looking at a situation where you can see Arsenal getting maybe 6 more points for the rest of the season. That is entirely possible. That is entirely possible. And, you know, the guy who puts his foot in the ball and says, you mess with him, you mess with me. Yes, that is necessary. Because the thing about Granit Xhaka is he can't do that because he's still kind of a head case. You can get in his head and make him do something stupid. He gets dumb yellow cards a little too often to make me comfortable. And I have not been of the biggest fan because I wasn't too pro of that move either. But I agree. He has blossomed and he has played better, and Arteta's records are showing it when he's on the field. But I would like to have seen him be available with this stretch of games coming, because Wolves are better than Arsenal. Leicester is just flat out better than Arsenal. Spurs are just flat out better. And Spurs, outside of Manchester United, have greatly benefited from this break by getting their players healthy, whereas you're looking at Arsenal, who seems to be snake bitten again. I was looking for, there's an old Arsenal shield where the cannon is not a cannon, but it's like the same, it's a brass wheelchair. I was looking for that so I could post that as my Reddit logo, because that's basically what that's happening again. That injury bug hits them and everybody just seems to fall. And but they have enough talent on the squad that they should be able to make up for it if they had the leadership that was there to coach those guys up and to talk them up when they're on the field, smack them in the face, and get them going. The talent is there. There's no way this squad, with the money that they have spent and with the players that they are currently developing, should be sitting with a 0 goal differential on 40 points. You are dead mid-table. That's who you are. And, you know, you've never seen a team where the record is who they are more so than Arsenal. But without Bert Leno And I thought Emiliano Martinez played well in goalkeeper. I thought he did fine. But if he's going to be your goalkeeper, I don't know if he is good to save that one shot that saves you a draw, as Leno did time and time again this season.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. I think the only good news about Martinez in goal is that he obviously has played a lot of games for the reserves, as has Holding and Mustafi. So at least they all know each other quite well,
right,
having played for the reserves most of the season. We're now going to see what Arteta's made of. But I would tend to agree with the comment you made a few minutes ago, which is we might be only looking at 6 or 7 more points between now and the end of the season. So you're going to have to stop calling me London Sean and start calling me Devon Sean, because I have a feeling by the end of the season we're going to be the worst team in London. Watford probably have a chance of catching us up, and we're looking at Crystal Palace above Arsenal in the league table.
Yeah,
What's going on?
It's sickening. It's just sickening.
We will switch it over to Devon Sean, if that's what you request. London Sean had such a nice ring to it. I love that. But the one thing that I did notice from Arsenal was this. We finally had a Kieran Tierney sighting.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
we did.
And he actually played against Arsenal. I believe he played 90 minutes against
City.
City. And I tuned into the Brighton game a little late, so I didn't see the starting lineups to know whether he played against Brighton.
No, he subbed it against Brighton. He was a sub.
He subbed it, yeah. Kolasinac played
on
the left back.
But, I mean, there is a guy that I actually think could legitimately, but for the injury bug, be a real asset to the defense. But there is just so much going wrong for Arsenal. Arsenal would have been the story regardless of you two being on the show as Arsenal fans.
Yes,
would have been the story.
Yeah, still the story. Yeah.
Coming out of the first week, because they dropped the 6 points.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you that picking up anything at Manchester City was going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But given that it was the first game in 100 days, if there was ever a time to get them, that was then.
Mm-hmm.
The Brighton match was a total crash.
Mm-hmm.
It was a total crash, and losing that you lost to Brighton, combined with the fact that you also lost Leno in that game, that's a massive step down.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how good Martinez is in goal, was a massive step down.
Yes. Leno is putting himself in. I think he's now not the number. He's definitely the number three, but he's competing for the number two spot in Germany right now with how well he was playing prior to the injury.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing, though, because you've got, for the German goalkeeper, you've got Manuel Neuer, who is, he's Manuel Neuer. What do you say?
Manuel Neuer. I mean.
And Ter Stegen has done a phenomenal job at Barcelona. Very, very oddly to me, reminiscent of David De Gea's development, a goalkeeper who was bought into a high-profile team, struggled to adjust it at first, but once he was given the appropriate time to develop, really developed into an effective top-flight, top world-class caliber goalkeeper. I don't know who I would trust more out of the two of them, Leno or Ter Stegen. I mean, Neuer's Neuer. He's in a different class entirely.
And he's so accustomed to playing at that level.
And I don't believe I've seen a keeper play goal the way Manuel Neuer does since Peter Schmeichel left Manchester United. He's predatory. He's the last of those predatory keeper sweepers he effectively plays as a center back throughout most of the game. He is bound to make those boneheaded errors that only he can get away with. But every team that he's ever played for says, we account for this because we know who we've got in goal.
It's an interesting point you raised, Mike, as well, because not only have we obviously lost our first keeper, and I think Leno is a very, very, very capable keeper, but we haven't even got a backup because our third keeper, who is Stuart Macy, is out of contract in 4 days' time.
Well, so that was something else that I was going to bring up to you guys is Arsenal have very interesting contract decisions that they need to make, and they said they need to make them by tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yep.
As far as what to do with Mari, the injured defender.
The report is they want to keep Mari.
Yeah, I think they will keep Mari,
and I think that's a wise decision.
But Danny Ceballos, David Luiz, they have some lone players that they need to make some really serious decisions on in, you know, about 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, it's Matt Macy. Sorry, and Matt Macy is another one that we have to make a decision on. So there's stories today that we might even, and I can't believe that we're going to go to this depth. There's talk of us maybe picking up Joe Hart on a free transfer.
Oh, God.
Just recently.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, you give me nightmares. Nightmares,
yeah.
Well, look, it's not like you got Rob Green. Or Calamity David James.
Yeah, I was going to say David James. You know, I think, though, with the contract choices that they have to make, it's I don't see, at least far as the players that are on the squad that are kind of teetering, I don't see any of the players where you're going, they can't afford to lose X, Y, or Z. I mean, I really don't see that with any of the players that are currently, you know, going into their last year or are going to be out of contract. I don't think Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is unsellable. I don't. I don't think that Lacazette is unsellable. You know, I think he's still Lacazette. Only player that I would add to the current attacking lot that I would be very highly disappointed that they lose is Nicolas Pepe, because I think as he gets used to the Premier League, you saw flashes. And without him, he was the only one that was making Brighton do any work anyway. And so you're seeing he's coming. And I think in by next season, he's going to be a very, very, very versatile and very dangerous winger that can also score you 10 to 20 goals. So,
for his price tag stead, I'd like to see a guy that was starting more consistently.
Oh, agreed. And I think starting next season that he will be. I just don't see how he wouldn't be after this year plays out.
I find it interesting that you guys went with the kid, Eddie Nketiah, as opposed to either Pepe or Lacazette. Against Manchester City. I found it
The lineup was quite young against Manchester City, and I took it as, again, I didn't think it was fully necessary that they, like, we have to get a point here. It really was a rust game, and it just didn't seem to be too detrimental to play some of your younger players in that particular game. I just didn't see it as too much of an issue, because you saw a game that they were expecting to win and win handily against Brighton. Lacazette, Aubameyang, and Pepe all started. So I that's the way I've read it. Of course, these are my eyes. I'm not in the room, but it's possible to interpret the situation in that way.
I think you always know when your club is in trouble, where if you ask 10 different Arsenal fans who would their first team be, you would get 10 different
teams. Yeah, you would.
And that And that just shows that we haven't really found any stability anywhere. And it's very typical of the fan base to start blaming people or blaming the manager for not putting players in the team when the team loses. But I can't see Mesut Ozil making a jot of difference playing at the moment. We're going to have to try and muddle through in a way. When I say muddle through, I think let's look at this positively. You're right, Stead, we've got a very talented squad. And the way we'll find out whether they can make it or not is by playing them. So I hope now that there's a chance that he'll put some of the youngsters. I'd like to see a bit more of Reece Nelson as well, to see whether he has got the ability to come through and to make it.
I want to see more of Martinelli as well.
And Martinelli, but I think Martinelli might have COVID-19. I think that's the problem because it's Torreira. Torreira has it. There's apparently two other players who were in close contact with you can imagine that the Spanish speaking players are probably the ones that socialise together. But and going back to Pepe, I agree with you. I think we haven't yet seen the best of him, and I think Arteta will use it to his advantage because one of the things you always notice with Pepe is he always has two defenders that go across to him, and the fact that draw two people towards him has got to create space somewhere else on the field of the attack. And let's hope that not only can we get Pepe scoring, but that we can take advantage of the fact that he's quite heavily man-marked during the games.
So in the last couple of minutes I got left, London Sean, I'm not going to ask that this question because he and I have gone over this on the pod many times. But of the pseudo tops big six that are currently in assured Champions League positions.
Yeah. Twist the dagger in a bit harder, Mike.
Huh?
I said twist the dagger in a bit harder. Yep.
Well, you have Arsenal, Manchester United, and Tottenham. Of those three, which one would you feel the most secure with going forward?
In the current form, and we've only got a couple of, in Man U's case, only one game to base this on, I think Man U probably now look as though they're the team that could spring forward. I enjoyed watching the Man U, Tottenham Man U game, I should say, on Friday. I think both of those teams put up a very good performance. It was a good game to watch. I think you and I exchanged a couple of messages before the game, and we both predicted the result.
1-1.
1-1. But I think Man U have got the capability, and of course you've got something to look forward to because Pogba looked very strong when he came on for that game.
Yeah, he
looked really good, and I think most Man U fans will be looking forward now to hopefully seeing the Fernandes-Pogba midfield, for the last seven or eight games of the season. And I think that sets up Man U really nicely for next year. You've managed to give your youngsters a few games this season as well, haven't you? So I'm thinking in particular of your guy up front, Greenwood.
He looks like he has all the looks at 17 years old of a future England player. He's a guy I could easily see in maybe not the Euros next year, but certainly in the calling for the World Cup. And he would bring something different to England that I don't know. I can't remember the last time that they've had, Sean, and that's a attacker with a left. I can't remember the last time that England had a international caliber attacker who was truly left-sided.
Left-footed. That's a good question.
Yeah. I can't think of anybody on the team that has been left-footed, that has been one of those. And to see him introduced into that mix, like United would need to United would need to shift formations. I think you'll see it coming up on Wednesday against Sheffield United, where they may run out the 4-3-3 with a McTominay or Fred or Nemanja Matic as a holding midfielder opposite with, and then Pogba and Bruno Fernandes playing the more advanced roles. And I think those we saw against Tottenham when Paul Pogba was introduced in the second half, it totally changed the dynamic of the game. But gentlemen, my gosh, time has flown. I want to give a big shout out to Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier social distancing restaurant. They had a great Father's Day special yesterday with Surf and Turf Suite to Die For, and they will be the place that we can still go and watch Premier League games. So 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier social distancing and sports establishment. But in the last couple of minutes, we've got parting shots and keep them to 30 seconds or less. London, Sean.
My parting shot. I we just mentioned the team, but I think there's one player who deserves an enormous shout out. Big news over here in the UK, which is Marcus Rashford, for the amount of money and food that he has donated to the food bank in Manchester. It's quite an incredible story that we've kept under wraps that sort of came out into the public arena about a week ago. But I take my hat off to Mr. Rashford. If you consider all of the bad publicity that Premiership football has brought at the start of lockdown with parties going on and this, that and the next thing, it's lovely to see that we have a great young Englishman who obviously is bigger than the sum of his parts. So well done, Marcus Rashford.
British Will told me Marcus Rashford right now, after getting a free lunch for the kids, could be the only person to score a 94th minute winner against the Cop and for Manchester United and still get cheered.
Yes. Correct.
Dead.
Yeah, I think in my in me and Sean's anguish about the inner goings of our team, I know we've discussed this a couple times, but I think a team to really watch going forward the rest of the season is Wolves. So they they don't have the most difficult path for the remainder of the season. They're not playing too many of teams that are above them in the table, and they're still alive in the Europa League, which isn't going to come on until after the season's over. So, you know, that's going to be a team I think people should pay attention to see how they finish out. Their title points to Manchester United, they're five behind Chelsea, and the way they're playing, it's not out of the realm for them to finish fourth and win a Europa League title.
I want to give myself a pat on the back with the time that I've got left, because I said against you guys or with you guys that Atleti was going to still finish third in La Liga.
You did.
They have bolted themselves up to third, and La Liga is going to be the only league that we have left that really has a discernible title race. Barcelona's draw 0-0 against Sevilla this weekend means that it's going to be some really complex permutation of goal differential and head-to-head. I don't really understand where it's coming from, and I'm not going to purport to, but somehow they made it. But a big shout-out to producer Paul. Thanks for coming on and keeping the trains running on time. Thanks to Uncle Leo for coming on and joining us. Thank you to El Haji Fall for joining us tonight and giving us his view on restart. Thank you, London Sean, for continuing to wake up and give us your thoughts early in the morning. We're going to give you a break and let you get some sleep over the next couple of weeks. So we'll have you on about in another month or so.
Okay. Sounds great.
Willing.
I won't have to talk about Arsenal defeats every week.
Thank you. Yeah.
Don't worry, Sean. I'm gonna get your number from Mike. I'll be texting you on my own English.
Okay. It's been fun. This has been the Two Guys Soccer Show. I'm Mike Stead. We did all right this week. We'll try and do better next. Talk to you all later.